Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, we're excited to have Tom Davenport. Tom is a world-renowned thought leader and author, and he is the president's distinguished professor of information technology and management at Babson College. He's the co-founder of the International Institute for Analytics, a fellow of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, and a senior advisor to Deloitte Analytics. He teaches analytics and big data in executive programs at Babson, Harvard Business School, MIT Sloan School, and Boston University. He pioneered the concept of competing on analytics with his best-selling 2006 Harvard Business Review article. He is the author and co-author of 20 books, including his most recent, The AI Advantage, How to Put the Artificial Intelligence Revolution to Work, and has written over 200 articles for HBR, Sloan Management Review, and the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and many other publications. Tom helps organizations to transform their management practices in digital business domains such as AI, analytics, information and knowledge management, process management, and enterprise systems. Tom has earned his PhD from Harvard in social science and has taught at the Harvard Business School, University of Chicago, and Dartmouth. His website is www.tomdavenport.com, and he has a really easy Twitter, at tdav, so that's at T-D-A-V. That's an awesome Twitter handle. So thank you so much for being with us, Tom, from Sarasota.
My pleasure. Nice to
be
here.
Thanks so much. This is our 15th year. This year is AI in society. And as I often start these podcasts, I ask the guests, so Tom, tell us about your journey, particularly different from the bio, and how you began your work with AI.
Sure. So I've been around the block a number of times. And was I think I first started working with AI stuff. I was a researcher at a consulting firm in Cambridge, Mass. And we looked at, this was with the late Professor Michael Hammer, who had been an MIT professor, and we looked at different technologies of interest to organizations, and we did one on expert systems, which were hot in the 80s, and then actually my company spun off an expert systems company to do financial planning, and Cambridge had lots of expert systems-oriented companies around, and they all went out of business. That was one of the AI springs, and then we had a couple of AI winters, and during that I hibernated in areas like knowledge management and so on, and then I got into analytics and big data in the 2000s, and that evolved into AI. So my interests are kind of at the intersection of knowledge and information, and how do you make them be used more effectively within organizations, and AI is pretty much the way everybody wants to do that now. So I started working in.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your book. So the recent book is, you obviously co-authored many books, but the most recent one is AI Advantage, How to Put the Artificial Intelligence Revolution to Work. Is that mostly about how to use AI in business? I assume that's what the focus is.
It is. I had written or co-authored one previous book called Only Humans Need Apply about what AI does to jobs and skills. And then this one is about sort of enterprise level application of AI and what are mostly big companies doing and how are they getting value, how are they managing it, what does it mean for, again, jobs and skills a bit, and then how do you make it work for the good of the society as well as the company?
So that is the sort of the topic of our theme, if you will, for the year. I mean, it's not just about AI particularly, but it's about, you know, how does AI affect society. And the first person we had on in January was an ethicist, talked a little bit about that. And last month we talked a little bit about jobs. And I want to talk with you about that a little bit if we could.
Great.
Because there's this PR sort of nightmare, I think. I mean, I call it because I think it's ill-suited, essentially. that, you know, that AI is going to take away all the jobs and, you know, then we're stuck. And I guess AI will also produce jobs as well. So I guess I want to hear your opinion about that and where you stand on that.
Well, I have been for a number of years what I call an augmentarian about AI. I think that it's mostly going to augment human capabilities, and human capabilities are going to augment it more than large-scale automation and job loss. However, you know, you try to walk this thin line between reassuring people but also saying you can't be complacent about it because, A, we don't really know for sure, and B, it's pretty clear to me that the only people who will lose their jobs are those who refuse to work with artificial intelligence. I mean, in the same way that, you know, a cab driver might lose their job because they don't work with the AI in Uber or Lyft or whatever. So I think we all have to think about how do we add value to these systems and what particular niche can we fill relative to them. In my previous book, we talked about five different ways that you can add value to AI, and that might be doing things that AI can't do at all, or it might be working alongside it as a colleague.
Mm-hmm. You used the word augmentarian. I didn't know that existed. I like it.
Yeah, I wrote a little piece once called "We Are All Augmentarians Now."
Yes.
But then after, you always think that you've got it all figured out, and then you realize that, well, maybe it's not quite so easy after all, because I do some work with Deloitte, and I was working on a survey with them last year of large U.S. Company executives, and 64% agreed with the statement that we want to automate as many jobs as possible to cut costs. And so who knows what's going to happen, but so far it looks pretty good in terms of the companies that are doing AI are not reducing jobs in any substantial way at all thus far.
Well, I mean, in that situation, I mean, that does, in out of context, say it, that sounds, you know, harsh, obviously.
Yeah.
But it also, again, I'm still think super positive about this, whereas it's like, well, they're going to try to automate things. Like, yeah, like if I had a bot who could do my calendaring, yeah, like I'll take that any moment, right? So hopefully we can use AI to routinize things, and then the people that would normally be doing calendaring can do other things that are helpful to the company. I think that and some of that might, you know, mean training, and some of it may not require training. How do we get people to jump on that bandwagon? You know, is it a PR problem? Is it a culture problem? Is it a leadership problem? Is it all those problems?
Well, I think there's more leadership than anything else is needed. I mean, I just finished an article for a new publication that this company ServiceNow, based in the Bay Area, sponsored, and they did some surveys, a global survey of workers, and then a survey of executives, and the survey of workers suggested that people are not really negative at all about AI and automation in general. ServiceNow is kind of, you could argue about whether it's AI, but it's certainly about automation. And they're not worried that they're going to lose their jobs, but they are worried that they're not going to be retrained and that nobody's going to tell them what they need to do in order to be useful in this space. And I think executives and the, you know, people in human resource organizations whose job it is to sort of think about the workforce are not really stepping up yet, saying, one, we're committed to, you know, helping you find a place in this future of work, and two, here's what you need to do. I mean, it's not easy because obviously we don't know exactly what the AI is going to be able to do, but we can do some general things now, and for some specific jobs we can we can start to do some things that are you know, more detailed about what skills are necessary and what the work process is going to look like. So I really think it's a more leadership problem right now than anything else.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking too that, like, where is education here? Like, where are the community colleges in this? How do we partner? How do, for example, enterprises, corporations, partner with community colleges?
That's been a big problem in the United States.
I know.
We think that everybody needs to go to a 4-year college and get a degree, and they don't, and so we haven't really invested in, vocational education on a large scale at all. And I did a project about this a number of years ago for Manpower, the temporary organization. It's very patchwork. I mean, some community colleges do an excellent job and really they create apprenticeships and work with companies and so on, but the few and far between.
So we've talked about this idea of jobs, job training, and it obviously a long way to go in terms of whether or not it can be solved. But it is interesting to hear you talk about these studies, because I think the idea of workers being concerned about retraining is, obviously brought out as far as public relations, things like that. Tell us a little bit more about some of the work you do in terms of how businesses are applying AI to support their needs. So, I'm thinking about marketing, obviously, and in terms of specialization and personalization. There's a whole host of things. So maybe give us some examples of that.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, at a very high level there, I'd say large U.S. companies, about 30% are, doing substantial work with AI, and it's mostly pretty what I sometimes call low-hanging fruit, in the sense that it's not that dramatic. It's very useful, but it does, small tasks more effectively. It makes somewhat better decisions than were being made before. But even at places like Amazon, they have a couple of so-called moonshot projects. Amazon Go was one, and started to roll it out more broadly. And it's, interestingly enough, to our previous discussion, I went to the one in Seattle. This is a convenience store, mind you. And
yeah, I've been there. I've been at it. It's really, really
weird. Yeah. It's strange to walk out and not pay.
Yeah.
But I guess the good news, if you're a human, is when I was there, there were three humans manning this facility, one to help you with the app to get in, one to check my ID because they must think that I look very close to 21. they didn't seem to think a machine was good enough for that. And then somebody, I was buying some wine, and somebody, not me, I promise, dropped their bottle of wine, and it broke all over the place, and a man came out from the back and started to mop it up. So
they have people there.
Yeah, humans are not going away. But Amazon, the drone delivery thing, that's another sort of moonshot idea. Who knows if that will take place ever or anytime soon. But Jeff Bezos is quite clear that the vast bulk of what they do with AI, I love his phrase, quietly but meaningfully improving core operations. So a little bit better recommendations, a little bit better figuring out how much inventory there needs to be in each distribution center, all these things that we've been doing for a while, but we can do a little better with AI. So, and that's the bulk of what's happening. I mean, we've had targeted marketing, personalized content, et cetera, for a while. But we can make it better if we have some good data and we develop a good machine learning algorithm. Digital marketing is almost exclusively driven by AI. Figuring out what what ad to show on what publisher's website, all of which, you know, has to be done in a few milliseconds. No human could certainly ever do that. You see it a fair amount in human resources where companies are identifying the employees most likely to succeed in terms of, you know, what backgrounds are associated with high levels of performance, and then also which ones are most likely to leave, so you can target an intervention for them if you want to keep them around, that sort of thing. A lot of financial sorts of activities, like, you know, deciding who gets credit or who's likely to commit fraud. I mean, those have been around for a while, but they're getting better and better with AI. So, you know, it's really evolutionary, not revolutionary so far. And I think if you look over a decade or so, it might well, looking back, look revolutionary, but it's going to take a while to get there.
Yeah, and that's a really important point about it's taking a while to get there. It's because and we've been doing it for a long time. It's just that it seems like this is a spring because it's you know, if you think about like the last 10 years, you know, Google's been doing this obviously since the beginning, but it seems like things are accelerating. I think that maybe that's just the PR, or maybe that's just more the bulk of the companies are using it more. I don't know, but it does seem like in the last, let's say, 2 years that it's accelerating, and it seems like that's what's kind of concerning people, that they're going to – it's like a takeover almost. It feels like a takeover, and what people are scared about. Is that a good synopsis of it, or what?
Well, it is accelerating. I mean, by any measure, the number of startups is accelerating. The number of the amount of venture capital going into it is accelerating. The number of projects within companies. I mean, in 2016, Google said they had 1,700 AI projects, and they don't even bother to count them anymore. There's so many. So it is accelerating, but I think it's important to remember that you know, machine learning has been with us for 40 or so years in the form of, you know, predictive analytics, predicting, you know, are you going to pay back that loan on your credit card, and hence what should your credit score be? That came out in the 60s and 70s, you know, from FICO. We're getting better at it, and there's some new techniques, and certainly some of the most of the excitement in the Bay Area is around things like deep learning, which, you know, relatively new techniques. Again, academics were writing about them in the 1980s, but certainly refined, and more companies are adopting them and so on. But I think people shouldn't fear it. It's not as if it hasn't existed before.
Right. And then you throw around some terms here that I probably should have talked about at the beginning, because I think, you know, AI, deep learning, machine learning, I mean, they're all a little bit different. So can you give us just the primer, real quick primer on like the different types of AI, how machine learning is an aspect of that, and then how deep learning, could you do that real quick?
Yeah, so there are three sort of fundamental types of AI.
Right.
One is statistical in nature, and machine learning is statistical. Deep learning is a form of machine learning. That's statistical. Neural networks are really what deep learning is a more complex form of. That's statistical. So it's all based on numbers and statistical analysis, and it's just, you know, somewhat more sophisticated than what we used to call, you know, analytics or business intelligence or whatever. Then there is the semantic approach to AI, which looks at language and the relationships among linguistic terms, and you know, what's the terminology that a customer might use in a call with a chatbot or intelligent agent, and how do these relate to each other, and what's the fundamental meaning of what they're talking about. Now, to kind of confuse things a little bit, you can now do several forms of this language processing with statistical AI as well. You know, you can recognize speech, you can Google Translate does a great job now with deep learning at the core. So we have two approaches to language. One is the more traditional semantic one. One is the statistical one. The semantic one is the one that sort of thinks the way human brains do to sort of analyze language and figure out what people mean by it. And that hasn't really prospered quite as much as the statistical approach has over the last several years, but it is still a fundamental approach. And then there's the yesterday's approach to AI that was based on rules and logic, and that's still around. I mean, my surveys suggest that about half of U.S. companies are still using rule-based systems, and they tend to not do very well when you get over a few hundred rules. It just gets way too complex and way too difficult to update. But they have the virtue of interpretability. You know, you can look at a bunch of if-then rules and figure out what the heck is going on and modify it easily, even if you're, you know, not a technical person. So I don't think they're going to go away ever, although they're really useful for only, you know, certain classes of small problems. So those are the three basic types.
And those, and now, would that be considered all narrow AI, what you just explained?
That's all there really is now, is narrow AI. We hope, we hope or we fear at some point that we'll have general artificial intelligence, which will do sort of everything that we do, only better, and kind of combine all of these different capabilities that I've described and just be, you know, smarter than us at everything, the singularity, if you will. But that doesn't exist now, and some people think it'll never exist. Martin Ford, who lives in the Bay Area, has just done, a nice book where he talks to the really smart, you know, AI researchers, and one of the questions he asked them is, you know, when is this coming, general AI, the singularity, et cetera? And I think the most aggressive prediction was 30 years from now, and several people said never, and some people said, you know, 100, 200 years. So we've got a few years to go.
Well,
as
then
humans.
So just for people on the call to understand, so narrow AI is many examples you've been between us, and there it's clearly what we have now, and it's just getting better at specificity, like whether that's somebody, a robot, you know, being us at a chess game, it's something very specific. Where general AI is actually mimicking a human, which you're saying between 30 and 200 years. And then there's super AI, which is the scariest. So which can go
beyond. Yeah, where it's so much better than us at everything that, you know, we can't even begin to fathom
right.
at all.
Fathom that, right. So we don't even want to talk about that. Okay. Okay, let's talk about leadership a little bit, because I think that people on the call, and then of course people who are listening to this after the call, would benefit from when you're working as a consultant with leaders in terms of how to institute or integrate, I think it's probably a better word, integrate AI and machine learning into companies, and then how that affects customers. Tell us a little bit of how you work with leaders and what you think the important attributes are.
Well, yeah, it's not an easy thing to do for leaders to get this and figure out how it fits with their organizations, because first you have to understand, you know, what are the different technologies and what can they do, and, you know, that requires a fair amount of education or self-training or whatever. And then you've got to think about how do all these little bitty pieces of capability that AI offers, these little tasks that it can do, these narrow AI systems, how do they fit into some big, ambitious objective for, you know, changing my organization or changing the world? So sadly, you know, right now, most of what AI does, I guess it's sad, is not that terribly impressive. You know, even to Jeff Bezos's organization at Amazon, it's not that impressive. But you, if you add it all up and have a kind of a coherent way of putting all these little pieces together, you can do some great things. So, you know, that's one of the things we're trying to do with autonomous vehicles, is to say, okay, we need to be able to, you know, drive the car and stay on the road. And we can pretty much do that with the existing forms of autonomy that are out there. We also need to be able to recognize pedestrians and various kinds of street signs, and even start to identify the intention of a pedestrian. Are they going to cross the street? Are they looking like they're about ready to walk? What happens in bad weather, and how do we start to distinguish the road and curves and other vehicles and so on in rain or fog or, you know, any of these sorts of things? How do we start to figure out what other vehicles are going to do, autonomous or otherwise? And that's probably going to require vehicles starting to talk to each other in sort of a common language. We don't have anything like that now. So, I mean, I frankly think we're a ways away from large-scale autonomous vehicles, and people who know much more about it than I do seem to agree, because we have to put together so many pieces to make this work.
Yeah, I agree. I think that just every time you think you're getting somewhere, then there's a crash. It's like sort of like it all goes away for a little while, and then
exactly.
It's just so many factors, right? I mean, so many. You have to have sensors. So many sensors. I don't know.
Make sense of everything that they're mm-hmm. saying in a way that we can't always do. Yeah. So, you know, I think we'll have smaller versions of this. We'll have protected areas within some cities that where the streets are so well mapped out and pedestrians are not allowed to cross in those areas and so on, where we'll be fine in those restricted circumstances, and we won't allow, you know, these things to go in snow or fog or heavy rain or something like that. Or even on highways, maybe we'll have protected lanes for trucks that are, at least, you know, while on those interstates, they'll drive autonomously. But then, you know, a human driver will probably have to take over when it's time to take it into the city and drop the stuff off.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I could totally see it, like, I'm just thinking about, like, Denver, Colorado, where they have, like, the downtown area where there's the little tram buses, and it's like, you know, as long as it's on a track and there's no, and they can make it, like, no people can cross the street or something. I mean, there's it's a really good idea, and there's certain things you can do that aren't that hard to, that could really make a difference to downtown areas.
Some mining companies already have that for mining trucks, which drive on perfectly, you know, private protected roads, and nobody can get in the way of them.
Right. That makes total sense. What's next? Like, let me ask you about change. I'm your change expert. I mean, we do a lot of stuff around change as well, and it's like, you know, mostly from a culture perspective. But, you know, how is this acceleration, what we're in now, how is this any different from just change management that leaders have to deal with? I mean, is there a difference that really? Is it this particular digital transformation is different from the last version? What's your opinion about that?
Well, I think that there is a lot of change management, and it's pretty much the same as what we've always known, with one key difference, which is that we have the possibility, in this case, of starting to take humans out of the equation. You know, so I was talking about this on a webcast earlier this morning, where I did some work with a small consulting firm called New Vantage Partners, where we surveyed, you know, CIOs, CTOs, chief data and analytics officers, thing, you know, what's happening in your organizations? Are they becoming data-driven? Do they have data-driven cultures, et cetera? And the answer was kind of depressing, frankly. You know, 70 or so percent said, no, we haven't really achieved that. Maybe it's even a little bit higher. And despite, you know, we've been working on this for a long time. And so, you know, you're faced with the prospect of taking an individual manager professional and saying, okay, you need to change and use data to make that decision because, you know, we have pretty good evidence that making database decisions is often more accurate than using your experience or your intuition unless, you know, you've made that decision over and over again. But the humans won't do it. So what do you do about that? Well, one answer is to say, okay, if the humans want change, we'll let a machine make that decision and we'll take it away from the human. So, I mean, that obviously requires some change management as well, but you're not trying to sort of change the headset of these recalcitrant carbon-based life forms anymore. You're replacing them with silicon-based life forms.
I'm just wondering about whether people in your position. Well, let me give you an example. So I had a client say to me, "Hey, you know, he's in BD, business development," and I said he was thinking about this is a big company, and he was thinking about going into BD in another part of the company that was AI driven. You know, it was AI division essentially. And he was like a little bit hesitant because he doesn't know anything about AI. And I like looked at him and I was like, what do you mean? Like, nobody knows anything about AI. Like, what's your problem? Just go learn about it and like everybody else is trying to do. So I'm just wondering, like, how do we as consultants catch up? I mean, we take it upon ourselves in my company just to learn about it, right? And then offering this forum so people can learn. But is there a particular way that you've been able to learn about it? I mean, obviously, we were already in the digital world, and it was very adjacent to what you already were doing. But do you have some ideas around how leaders can learn about AI in a way that would serve them?
Well, yeah, there's no shortage of opportunity for learning, and I think it's some combination of there's a lot of structured content out there about AI, you know, all these MOOCs, if you will, that are created by some of the world's greatest AI researchers. It requires a lot of motivation, but it doesn't require much money or anything like that. It's very easy to do logistically. So there's that. And then I think it's just talking to other people in your organization and sometimes competitors or peers in other organizations, you know, what are you doing with this stuff? What's the experience that you're having? Mm-hmm, and, you know, I think that I did this at one point in my career. I'd done a lot of work on analytics and had written several books on analytics. And then this thing called big data started appearing. And I thought, yeah, you know, it's the same thing as analytics, really. I don't need to do any research in that area. It's just a new name for the same thing. And then I realized maybe that was short-sighted. Perhaps I should actually do some research in that area. And I started to do research in that area. I did 3 or 4 projects and eventually ended up writing a book on big data and found there were some substantial differences and it was not correct that it was exactly the same thing. And I think we have to be open to the fact that we don't know enough. We have to keep learning. Mm-hmm. We have to, you know, and it's good for you. I mean, it keeps your brain agile. It keeps you from getting dementia. It keeps you young. So, unfortunately, we haven't quite figured out the formula for inculcating intellectual curiosity in people, and some have it and some don't, and it's unfortunate because I think that's really going to be the only long-term competitive advantage for individuals is intellectual curiosity and the motivation to really pursue it.
Yeah. So along those lines, I have a 13-year-old, and I know people on the call have kids, clearly. I don't know if you have kids or not, but
I do.
How old are they?
One's turning 30 next month, and the other's 33, I think.
So they've passed their screen. You had to argue with them about screen time in a different way when they were.
Yeah, I was lucky. I'm glad that there were no smartphones available or anything. You know, I see these parents of young children, you know, talking on their smartphones instead of talking to their children, and I think, what a horrible thing to do. But I hope I would not have done that as well.
Yeah. So that's kind of my point here. Like we have always, my company have always been, I guess, I don't know what the word, sensitive to, helping our clients and helping our clients, ecosystems, if you will, break up with their phone at some point. You know, there's actually a book called How to Break Up with Your Phone these days. I'm having some of my clients.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I actually started to read it, and I couldn't even read it. I just had to listen to it because I'm so distracted by reading. So anyway, which just tells you a little bit about how much I look at my phone. But anyway, there's a place, obviously, for no phones and no screens. And so my philosophy about this is that it's just going to get worse. I mean, AI is just going to create more chance to be influenced by, advertising. You know, your kids are on YouTube, and they're constantly being influenced by advertising. You know, what's your opinion about how do we sort of de-accelerate what is clearly going to be an acceleration of information in terms of how do we stay human, in terms of our connection? Kind of a big thing.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking about this with a reporter the other day. I wrote a book in 2001 called The Attention Economy that was arguing that, there's so much information available now that our attention is the scarcest resource and it's becoming much more valuable and we need to, husband it more carefully. And he said, obviously things are a lot worse now. But I decided in that conversation that I'm not a political libertarian, but I am kind of an attention libertarian for adults. I'm not for kids, obviously, because I think kids' brains need to develop away from some of these things. But I don't know. I personally talk to people a fair amount about do they feel manipulated by the Googles and the Facebooks and so on of the world? Do they feel like they want to get off of it as a result? And most of the people I talk to say, no, I'm in control of it. It's my attention. I'll devote it where I want to. And that's always the way I've felt about my students. If they want to look at their laptops in class, they're paying for this education. It's pretty much up to them. I might ask them a question to embarrass them a little bit or something if they're not paying attention to me. But I think that we just have to make these decisions for ourselves. And, the average, it's not entirely new in that when I wrote that book, The Attention Economy, the average American was watching 4 hours and 37 minutes of television a day.
Is it
really any worse if you're on YouTube and Facebook for 4 hours and 37 minutes a day? And the total amount, I don't think, is going up. People still have to sleep and eat and so on. So,
well, the difference, I think, because I literally have rules about this at my house around TV time and screen time, is that TV time, like, I actually have Max come upstairs and watch TV with me. So there is actually a difference in terms of you could do something with the person. I also have him come upstairs and show me his YouTube videos. So, like, I try to make screen time that we do together so that it's not so isolating. So I have all these, like, tricks I try to do, and it's still, like, there's still arguments about it. But it's just hard, It's like it's super hard. And I think you still have to have, rules with kids, and otherwise it's out of control. Like, they'll be on it all the time. I think there was some.
I agree. As I say, for kids, I think there definitely have to be rules about it. And I don't know when those rules need to be eased. At what age you start developing enough mental capacity to make your own decisions about that sort of thing. But for adults, generally, I don't worry about it quite so
much. And I'm just curious, in your classes, aren't most of your students taking notes on their laptops?
I mean, it's hard to detect, although, you know, there is some data suggesting, I don't do this myself, but there's some data suggesting that you will remember the content much better if you actually write it down by hand rather than doing it on your laptop. But that's not enough for me to abandon my laptop. I still find it much more useful to capture things that way. But there are, I taught at Harvard Business School a few years ago, and they have a policy against even having a laptop open in class. I thought it was kind of nutty, but I believe it's still in place.
Interesting. Last question, then we'll be done here. So what would you say moving forward is the greatest challenge that businesses are facing right now with regards to AI? Like, what is the one thing that people definitely have to focus on?
You know, I think it's just knowing enough about it to put together a strategy for how does it fit my organization? How's it going to advance my business model? I'm doing some work with a company now. It's called AI Matters, and they do AI-based diagnosis of what your business model is based on external data. And there's a huge amount of difference in the valuation for different business models. If you're making things, hard assets like cars or clothes or whatever, you tend to be valued very low relative to other companies. Sometimes, you know, less than you're valued less than your annual revenues. If you are, on the other hand, the opposite extreme is, you know, a platform, an Uber, an Airbnb, or something like that, that has very few assets but does great things for customers, you might be valued at 9 or 10 times revenues on average. Can I change my business model to do that sort of thing with AI? You can't really do those kinds of business models without AI, but just having AI is not going to change your model. So that, I think, is a really tough thing to think about. If you're in one of those traditional businesses, how do you move toward one that, you know, where data is the primary asset and where you're connecting customers with other kinds of resources they need, not necessarily, you know, heating, beating, and bending stuff to produce it yourself. That's not easy at all.
Interesting. Okay, awesome. Well, Tom, thanks so much. It's been really interesting to talk with you, and you've got great examples, and you've got really good insights, and I think people will find this really, really helpful. So again, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks for your great question.
Tom, thanks. So Tom can be reached at TDAV. That's his Twitter account. And then you can also go to his website, tomdavenport.com. And I also want to remind people about next month. We continue on with our AI and society theme. We have Alexandra Leavitt. She's the author of Humanity Works, Merging Technologies and People for the Workforce of the Future. That's going to be on April 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific. So, thanks again to everybody. I am off to Berlin with my kid, and the airplane is the only place I let him be on his device the whole time. So he gets a pass. I wish everybody well for a nice spring break, and we'll see you in April. Thanks so much. Bye, everybody.